it's Steve and Dave again. We are two guys in a river. I'm Steve Mathewson.
And I'm Dave Getz.
No doubt we all want to catch more fish. I want to, and Dave needs to.
Ooh, that hurts.
But we're all about fly fishing and our love for the outdoors, so let's get after it. There is a learning curve with fly fishing. By learning curve, we're referring to how long it takes to acquire new skills and knowledge about the craft of fly fishing. But Dave, I wonder if we should also talk about a learning cycle. I mean, what goes around comes around, right? And what I mean by that is that there are skills and insights that we have learned about fly fishing that we have to keep coming back to. We return to them. We keep relearning them. I know I need constant reminders of the skills and techniques and hacks and insights that I learned 5 years ago or 25 years ago.
This is really true with writing. I have two businesses. I have a strategic marketing business, but I also have another writing and publishing business in which we work with writers. And writing is one of those things that you always have to go back to the basics, like stripping out the adjectives from your sentences, shortening your sentences, giving your sentences cadence, alternating the length of your sentence. And these are just things that no matter how long you've been a writer, you can never stop relearning. And so I think that's what we're talking about today. So we're going to devote this podcast to discussing some of the things and lessons about that we've relearned recently when we were in Montana, and also the last few years. Some of them will help you catch more fish. Others will maybe just simply keep you safe. And at least one will hopefully make the experience more pleasant for the other fly fishers that you encounter. So let's
start with that last one, Dave. What's a lesson that we need to relearn in order to make the experience better for other fly fishers that we run into on the stream or the river?
So the first one is the need for etiquette, fly fishing etiquette. And there has been a huge burst of new fly fishers into the sport in recent years, and that's really a good thing. I think some days I don't think it's a good thing because I want fewer people on the stream, but I do think it is a good thing. But when that happens, some of these things that are passed on from like fly fisher to fly fisher, they're kind of unspoken. Mm-hmm. They aren't articulated very well. And one of them is fly fishing etiquette. Just to give you an example, so one day recently we were fishing in Montana, we were fishing the Boulder, and Steve and I typically, we rarely now do a float trip just because we love to wade fish. We feel like you actually really get to fish when you're wade fishing and what you
and it's
learn.
Cheaper.
And it's cheaper. Yeah. And gosh, we've been on a lot of float trips where we just didn't catch that many more fish. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we tend to be 90-95% of our time is wade fishing. So we were fishing right beneath this bridge, and Steve was below me. And so I was above him and upstream. And the Boulder right here is not very wide. And I was fishing this run, and down the stream comes a guide on a drift boat with a fly fisher.
It was kind of a drift raft.
Yeah,
not that
it was
matters,
not even a drift boat.
It was perfect for that river.
It was perfect for that river. So they didn't say anything when they floated by. They didn't turn their heads. They went directly into the pool that I was fishing. And they could have actually gone to the other side of the river and bypassed it. But they didn't even say anything. And the guy just kept fishing my run
as
he went
through. That's
what
gets me. You know, usually the etiquette is you pull up. You're not going to be casting when somebody else is fishing. And I can't remember how many drift boats over my lifetime have gone by me. And they all do that. The guys, they don't fish where you're fishing. You know, they'll wave and they'll wait and then they resume. But not this guy.
No, and so maybe these things need to be more explicit, or you know, more of the ethical side of fly fishing. It's not even ethical. It's just common courtesy that you don't fish through someone else's run. Or if you do, you at least acknowledge it because maybe you can't get that far onto the other side. It was so rude. And it was just, you could tell there's some rich guy in the front of this boat. Just, he was slinging streamers and he'd strip it in and just blew right through the run. and really messed up the run for probably 15 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that we told this story to a friend of ours who has been a guide out there, runs a fly shop, or used to run a fly shop, used to own a fly shop, and is a good friend of Steve's and has become a friend of mine through the years. But we were discussing this about fly fishing etiquette. He said, you know, one of the big problems today is that people just don't talk to each other. And he was giving this example, I don't know, someplace either on the Missouri, I forget where it was.
Yeah,
it
was or like, the Upper Madison. I can't remember
the Upper
which,
Madison,
yeah.
Where there's these big outfitters now that they'll put in 5 to 10 drift boats a day to get their lodge all out on the river, right? So imagine if you're trying to put in the river on that day and these people are going in every 15 minutes for 2 hours, right?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
so he was talking about this, and he was talking about talking with some of these people who were just so grumpy about, you know, how we're going to deal with this with all these new fly fishers and all these big outfitters that are trying to get their customers and their clients into the water while you're trying to fish. And it was just a good conversation about the importance of etiquette. But one of the takeaways was talk to people. And our friend Dave said, you know, the thing I would do is I would call up the outfitter maybe earlier in the season before it actually starts or some other time and say, hey, tell me, you know, what your plan is and if we can work together and then work around it. But
yeah,
I just thought it was a good example. But the takeaway was you have to talk to people. And I think when you're on the river and let's say you get to a spot and there's already someone there, just talking to them. Hey, you going upriver? You going downriver? Simply talk to people. And I think that really would help improve the etiquette on the river.
Absolutely. That's become a lost art, and it's just something that we've got to get back to, or there's going to be a lot more frustration and a lot more anger. And yeah, it's not that hard. There's plenty of river to share, but it's just a matter of communicating. Yeah, you know, something else that lesson I relearned is the value of a rod warranty. So Dave, I have now broken every fly rod that I own, well, almost, at least the important ones. So the last holdout was my go-to rod, my Winston Boron 2X, 9 foot, 6 weight, my all-around rod. And yeah, when we were fishing in Yellowstone together, it was actually that day on the boulder, wasn't it? Right at the end of the day, when we got out, we're walking, and all of a sudden, my reel fell off. And I thought, oh, what did I? It must have come loose. It fell off the reel seat. Well, no, the cork, that piece right below the cork handle had fallen off.
Yeah.
The blank was still there. The blank hadn't broken. You know, the rod itself. And I thought, how did that happen? I don't remember. You know, I didn't do anything. I was just walking, and then it dawned on me. A day before in Yellowstone Park, I had, I had stumbled and I let go of my rod, and I dropped it on some rocks, and, I learned this lesson a few years ago. I did that, and I'd buy these $150 reels, and they work great until you dropped them once, and then they bend. So I bought a, remember that? Few years ago, I bought that Galvin reel $250. It would be like a Sage Click just a really good, more machined. So it's, they're just bulletproof. Well, not quite bulletproof. But anyway, I dropped that, and I remember picking it up like, oh, no. Yeah, fine. Didn't ding it at all. Well, what happened? I think the shot got absorbed, and it cracked the cork, cracked that reel seat.
Yeah.
So eventually it just fell off. So yeah, I guess there's another lesson. If you pay for a good reel, you won't damage them as easily. But if you drop it, you might break the reel seat. So I'm going to have to send in this thing, and it's going to cost me a pretty penny because it's a Winston. But hey.
You haven't sent it in yet?
No, I haven't had time, but I will. And I knew I'm not going to be using it until next spring, so I'll get to that in the next week or so. But yeah, I mean, the value of a rod warranty. And remember, I in a previous podcast, my 9 foot 8 weight, I broke that this summer in Alaska. And
oh my gosh,
you know, and remember that 8.5 four weight that I love, I'm on like my second rod on that replacement. That's been broken a couple times, so
gosh,
yeah,
yeah. Well, you know what, that is the value of buying a rod with a warranty. So a couple years ago I picked up a 9-foot eight weight Winston, but it was used. I bought it off a fly shop. I got it for about half of what a new Winston is. And just this past weekend, Corey, as I mentioned in a previous episode, my son Corey, he went out and was headed to Michigan to fish for salmon. And I said, hey, Corey, do you have a rod? He goes, no, I think I'll take this spinning rod. I said, hey, why don't you take my 9-foot, 8-weight Winston? And then I paused and I said, Corey, I don't have a warranty on this, so be careful with this thing. So when you buy a used rod, you don't get that warranty. So there is something. So what is your warranty? Mm-hmm. What do you have to pay on that?
Oh, I think it's close to $100. Maybe it's a little bit more than that.
But
now.
It's the Winston, right? So that's $1,000.
I paid $625 back in the day, but I think the thing lists now at about $900, $950. So it's worth it.
Yeah.
It's worth it to do
it. Yep, the value of a rod warranty.
Yep. What else have we relearned this summer, Dave?
So we talked about this in a previous episode, but gosh, the need for constant adjustments. And I don't know where you learn this, because they don't teach you that when you start out fishing. You learn to cast. You don't learn anything about the river. You don't learn much about even hatches. But then you even start to learn about bugs, and you learn about, you know, dry flies and nymphs and, you know, terrestrials and emergers. You start to learn the different stages. The problem is, you don't really learn about the need for making adjustments on the fly. And it's not just reading the river. Sometimes you read the river and there's nothing to read. Often when we get to the driftless, there's nothing to read. There's nothing on the surface. Yes, you can pull up a rock and see the patently obvious, you know, some of the nymphs and the, you know, the different, maybe some caddis larvae. But sometimes there's nothing to read. So on those days, you just have to continue to make adjustments, and you cannot fish for 2 hours doing the same thing. And unless that's your thing and getting nothing. So I think you think about your approach, which is, are you going to fish dries? You're going to fish nymphs? You're going to fish streamers? A lot of us, like for me, I fish all three, and so I don't mind fishing a streamer. There's a few people that, you know, would never allow a streamer to touch the, you know, touch their fly rod, right?
Yeah.
But changing up patterns, changing up size, thinking of your brother who was fishing that little creek behind the coffee shop up in Silverthorne, Colorado, who he wasn't catching on. He was trying stimulators, and that's his go-to fly, right?
Yeah, yep.
And then he finds this Griffith's gnat, and that works. Suddenly he's catching fish. So this idea is really important. And then depth is also important, especially if you're nymph fishing.
Yep.
Making sure you're just down far enough and fishing into that lane where they typically are hitting in that area of the river.
Yep. We talked about it in a previous podcast. This year has been kind of just okay.
We've been fine.
It hasn't been great. But I think the good thing about it, it's forced me, because I get lazy. I tie something on and it's like, I'm going to catch a fish on this or not. And like, no. Sometimes you have to switch things up and... Yeah, that makes all the difference. I hate to admit it, but a lot of fly fishing is problem solving.
It is problem
solving.
And
I don't want that. I want to catch fish. I don't want to solve the problem. I want it to be super easy. But honest, if we're honest about it, no. Part of the fun, part of the challenge is, okay, they're not taking this. I got to try something else. And it's satisfying, isn't it, when you catch something else? So, hey, another thing that I relearned this summer is the value of a waiting staff. I just can't say enough about a waiting staff. Talked in a previous episode about the rattlesnake encounter. And by the way, I never said it in that encounter. Maybe people picked up on it, but we didn't kill that rattlesnake.
No, we didn't kill the rattlesnake.
We let it go. And
absolutely.
It's in its habitat. But I do think if you had you're dealing with a snake, you know, up close, that could be helpful. And even when I fell backwards like an idiot, when I stumbled over a rock, I knew I had that waiting staff. I was pretty sure I was out of striking distance, and I was, but I remember kind of grabbing onto that, like, if I need something, I'll use this.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, you know, and this occurred to me, Dave, I've not admitted this to you, so I'll just tell the world
on
the podcast.
Get it out.
Yes. You know what? At almost 62, I just find that I just don't have the stability in balance that I used to when I was 52 or 42. And, you know, it's not bad, but I notice it. And it's like, as I get older, I'm going to need that. That waiting staff is good. So you and I are still using the Orvis ones. I don't know that they make them. I really like those. But if I have to replace it, I think I'm just going to go in and buy one of those, what are those, trekking poles?
Yeah.
They're cheaper. And
they extend.
Yeah.
So it's like a telescopic extend.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I haven't seen the Orvis. I have to look. I'll have to do a deep dive into the different waiting staffs. But mine started to break this fall, so I got one after you got one. And I do think waiting staffs, just as you get older, but just there's just so many benefits for it when you're in the river and you're waiting, which brings us to our next point, which is the need for waiting safety. So I mentioned in this previous podcast that I fell in, and that's not the story really that I wanted to talk about today. Is when we were fishing the Boulder, I had a moment where you were, I think you were behind me still, and I was up ahead of you, and I crossed the Boulder. Yeah.
And I saw you cross it.
And I had my waiting staff, I was moving slow. I got in the middle of the Boulder, and I remember thinking, what the, and I think I used a really naughty, naughty word in my head, what the bleep am I doing? And I thought, what was I thinking? Because the river was so strong, and in the Boulder, just like on the Yellowstone, you have these boulders, right? These rock, and it's just not easy. It's not a sandy bottom. It's not a bottom of small rocks. It's these big chunky boulders, and they're not like huge, like, you know, like the size of, let's say, a chair, but they're small, and it's just so uncomfortable when you have that pressure coming down from the current. So it's just another point here of, I think our point is, if you don't have to wade, why are you wading?
Yeah. Yep.
You and I don't wade anymore on the Yellowstone. We don't take. We don't even bring our waders because we're not going to.
No, no.
You know, we've made that choice that we're not going to wade.
And we watched some people wading this fall when we were there. I just thought I wouldn't wade there because we have before and we turned back.
But I think our thing is, hey, we do. As I mentioned, we only do pretty much wade fishing. And you know, yes, you have to use it to cross, you know, different places to cross, but I just have taken a minimalist approach to wading. And, but I've, you know, I got over to the other side and I just thought, Dave, that was the stupidest crossing that you've made in a long, there was just no need for it.
Yep.
Anyway, so the value or the importance of wading safety and making good choices before you're in the middle of the river.
Yeah, absolutely. Think of anything else, Dave.
You know, another one was just, you know, as you get older, the value of physical health. So you tweaked your ankle early on. Was it the first day? When did you tweak your ankle?
Yeah, I think it was. It was the first day. How did I do? No, was that when, you know what, it was that night after the rattlesnake encounter when we were walking and I stepped in a hole.
Oh, that's right.
Remember that the Madison River? I stepped in a hole and really tweaked my ankle. And it didn't bother me too much that night, but boy, the next morning it was sore. Yeah.
And increasingly, because that was at the beginning of our trip, so hiking up the Yellowstone is, you know, there is some game trails that you're on, but once you're off the trail and you're along the bank, it's not easy.
Boy.
So it slowed you down. I was actually really worried about you. I thought, gosh, and one of the things that kept you from doing, I think, remember we were trying to scramble up the ravine and take the shortcut?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just harder for you because of the angle of your foot, right? By the way, we should tell, I didn't tell the story, but we were fishing the Yellowstone, and we were fishing right along the bank, but there's all these this overhang, and it's really hard to fish, hard to get through, actually.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's some shortcuts that you can take. Anyway, it's hard to explain, but I came up over the ridge, all of a sudden there was this bison that was feeding bull bison that was about, 40 yards away?
Yeah.
I'm like, holy cow, and there was no place to go. And so I thought, oh my gosh, the river was right there, and I kind of just sidled along, or I don't know if that's a word, kind of got back down and kind of worked myself right down the ridge and back down to the river, and kind of we walked around him. But there were two other bulls that were up there too that were laying down that we hadn't even seen. Yeah. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But the value of physical health, staying in shape, and just monitoring your health so that when you're out there on the river, you get a chance to do what you always do and not, your world becomes smaller when you don't have mobility.
That's really true. Great point. You know, maybe a final thing that we've relearned is just the appeal of fly fishing. And this is not something from our trip, but this is actually a couple days before we recorded this podcast. Legendary basketball coach Bobby Knight passed away. And one of our good friends with whom we fished this fall, his name is Dave, wrote this tribute, which I think captures Knight's love of fly fishing, and maybe even more than that, his complexity as a person. I just want to read this. So this is what Dave wrote. Yesterday was a feeling old day for me, precipitated by the news that legendary basketball coach Bobby Knight passed away at age 83. I had the honor to spend time with Coach Knight, guiding him on the rivers and streams in southwest Montana. Without question, he was one of the greatest college basketball coaches ever. But he was a complicated guy, prone to volcanic outbursts of temper and profound insensitivity. I saw these traits firsthand as I watched Knight coach in the 1992 NCAA Final Four in Minneapolis, sitting two rows behind the Indiana bench when he lost to his former player, Coach Mike Krzyzewski, in the semifinals while screaming obscenities at both his players and the officials.
Ooh, yeah. Wow.
That sounds like Bobby Knight, doesn't it? But Dave goes on. He says, he loved fly fishing in Montana, and I spent many days guiding him on his fly fishing trips to Bozeman. One of my favorite experiences was guiding both Coach Knight and his Ohio State teammate, John Havlicek. Can you imagine that?
Oh, that's so awesome.
You got Bobby Knight and John Havlicek for 3 days on Nelson Spring Creek, which I've fished before, even worked briefly on the ranch a few times back in the 80s. But anyway, he says, guiding him for 3 days on Nelson Spring Creek and the Bighorn River. He was kind to me, and I got along well with him. I do wish his legacy did not contain the bad things he did, like punching the cop in Puerto Rico, his chair-throwing incident, choking one of his players, and his nearly nonstop abuse of basketball officials who worked on his games. Spending almost 25 years as a basketball official myself, and by the way, Dave was a good one. He reffed when my kids were playing high school ball. Anyway, he said, Knight's nearly nonstop abuse of basketball officials who worked on his games. He said, spending almost 25 years as a basketball official myself, this behavior bothered me greatly. There are always pluses and minuses on the scoreboard in all of our lives. In my opinion, Coach Knight is still a winner.
Oh, man, what a great tribute.
Yeah, isn't that profound? And you're right, complicated.
You know, Steve, we all are complicated. I mean,
why we are. We sure are.
When you look at somebody like Bobby Knight, you see the extremes. But I think all of us are, in some sense, not unlike Bobby Knight. Maybe the point is we're really complicated. There's what people see of us. And then there's often another side. In his instance, I remember, who's the guy? Billis.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the announcer, did a tribute of him as well, and just said he was always kind to me.
Yeah.
They had this great friendship. And so there's always two sides.
There really is. I know a lot of people around Bozeman who encountered him really, really respected him, and he was very you know, kind to them. And I even read something the other day that one of the refs that was there at that game where he threw the chair, I think they were playing Purdue, he and this ref had a relationship, a friendship over the years, and they got beyond that. But, yeah. You know, Dave, I don't know if you remember this, but we missed Bobby Knight by a day the year we were fishing the Wyoming Bighorn. And that's
been eight or nine years ago. I forgot all about that.
Because we read the next day or a couple days later in the paper that he had fished that same stretch of the Wyoming Bighorn that we did near Thermopolis, Wyoming. And then we read that he hit a cow after fishing the river. It was dark. And remember, that's open range.
Yeah, you know, right. There's no fences.
No barbed wire fences there. Yeah. Just cattle roam wherever they want. And he hit one of them. Yeah. And
one of those big SUVs hit
I think it was a Ford Expedition. And,
oh, wow.
And so, yeah, that was our close encounter of the wrong kind, I guess, with Coach Knight. But
yeah, so I don't think I'm saying that, but, you know, justifying anything he did. Those were horrible things. I do think that you look at somebody like that and you see there's also this tender side to him. It's hard to understand, isn't it? It's hard to put together. It's hard to hold together.
Yeah, yep, it really is. Well, I guess what we're saying today is that once you've mastered the learning curve, hey, don't forget to embrace the learning cycle. You got to keep reminding yourself of what you already know. Get back to the fundamentals. And like you said at the beginning of the podcast, Dave, you do that in every discipline, in writing and in basketball. You know, good basketball coaches are going back and working on the fundamentals with their players. And when it comes to fly fishing, you'll be glad you did, and so will everyone else on the river.
Yeah, that's good. Certainly with the etiquette, that's for sure.
That's it.
One more thing before we go, just a reminder that the Kindle version of our book, The Fly Fisher's Book of Lists, Life is Short, Catch More Fish, the Kindle version is out. It's a lot cheaper than the print version. It's $6.97. So if you have not read the book or picked it up, jump on Amazon and pick it up.
And it's a reminder of what you already know. See what I did there, Dave?
So it'll help with your learning cycle.
Yes, exactly. Oh, boy. We delivered that really well, didn't we?
All right.
That's all for today. Thanks again for listening. I'm Steve Mathewson.
And I'm Dave Getz.
Until next time, we are two guys in a river.
For the love of fly fishing.